Well, that was kind of an interesting presentation to follow in terms of, I guess, in a nutshell, what I would say is I think when you're alone facing these issues, the decisions that you can make are very limited, and your ability to really live up to the values and the requirements of human rights, you may not be able to get there. I think it takes collective action to, and you need support from outside to do what you're doing. So it's inspiring to hear stories of courage from both of you, and to see that, you know, people who are doing correctional health are willing to do that. I'm going to present an example from a parallel profession where we're working on some of the same stuff. And I'm I don't have any disclosures to make. I'm an architect. This is my first time here, but it's a pleasure to be with you all. Thank you. So kind of, and I give this talk mostly to architects who I'm trying to influence. And my profession is mostly about building things. People get into it to try and make the world a better place, which we have something in common there. So, and what part of the message I try and convey is that human rights are not just about, yeah, there are violations, although there are, but also that there's a call within human rights to help society reach our highest aspirations. But in order to aim high, you also have to prevent things from getting too low, which is to say preventing buildings that violate human rights, especially in the prison context. And I would say, and this is the what I'll tell you about, that hopefully my profession will actually make a more formal commitment to refusing to participate in the worst projects, the ones that are intended for human rights violation. So on the upside, because again, my profession is very forward, positive looking, which is a good thing, and I kind of love the people in my profession, but sometimes it drives me nuts. But if you get down towards the bottom of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, you get to what are called economic and social rights, and I think it's nice to contextualize human rights work in this framework to remember that actually I should have changed the highlights here. People are entitled to housing and medical care. People are entitled to education and to participate in the cultural and scientific life of their communities. So what I tell my fellow professionals is, you know, they need spaces that are designed for those purposes to realize these rights, especially housing, but also medical care. If there's no medical clinics and hospitals that we've designed, how are people going to access their human rights? So human rights call on my profession to, you know, as part of the delivery system, not all of it by any means, but we have a key role to play. So that's great. And on the other side, which I think people are more familiar with, human rights place limitations on what we can do. You know, and that's kind of what Human Rights Watch and Amnesty International are famous for calling for. And when you read, again, some of the founding documents of human rights, the prison system gets very specific focus because that's where the government is most at risk of taking away your human rights. So people are entitled to dignity, and prisons are supposed to be about social rehabilitation. And, of course, the U.S. signed the ICCPR, but we don't consider it self-executing, so we haven't implemented all of it. There are cases where buildings were specifically designed for human rights abuse, and that's really the kind of concern that I'm trying to bring to my profession. I think Guantanamo Bay is probably the best example. The design itself was copied after U.S. prisons, primarily from Terre Haute, Indiana. But you know, the reason they located them in Guantanamo is pretty much because there was this legal fiction that this is a constitution-free zone. You know, your client comes to you and says, "I've got this great idea about, you know, building an interrogation center where I don't have to follow the U.S. Constitution. You know, would you want to work on that project?" It's like it's probably double the cost to build it in Cuba than it is to build it here, and you know, it's surrounded by a hostile foreign country. But you know, so I use this example to say, you know, if your client comes to you with that brief and you're an architect, you know, you should probably think about why is it that they're locating it here and what's the purpose of this project. Are you okay with that? Hopefully the answer is no. But two other cases kind of come up more often in the United States. One is execution chambers. And when you read, again, Declaration of Human Rights, ICCPR, and even statements from the General Assembly, there's a pretty strong consensus within human rights that the death penalty is a no-no. So why would you build a space that's intended to implement that in the United States? But this was actually a project that was completed in 2010. I believe it was started around 2007 by the state of California when there was actually legal challenges to the space in which executions were done, and they built a new death chamber. What was interesting is that I saw the architectural design. That was one of the computer models that was used in the design process published, and that's the space that actually corresponds to that room that was circled there, which as it got built out. And, of course, I mean, this is probably not new information to you, but the United States, from a human rights perspective, is a huge outlier in terms of maintaining the death penalty the way we do it, and the fact that there's a human rights perspective. There's also just a general justice or injustice perspective on the death penalty that, you know, that innocent people still get sentenced to die in the United States, and that even though the criminal justice system overall has a large disproportionate minority impact and, you know, basically many features of structural racism, the harshest parts of the criminal justice system are probably the most racist, and you certainly see that in the sentencing of people to death. The other big topic that I talk about with architects is solitary confinement and buildings that are intended for solitary confinement. And that first statement there is really important because it's the United Nations Special Rapporteur on Torture, and he's saying indefinite and prolonged solitary confinement in excess of 15 days should be absolutely prohibited. And there's another part, it's a little wordier, where he says that people who have mental health issues and juveniles should never be subjected to solitary confinement. So I think this changed the game. We built Pelican Bay State Prison in California in 1989. A lot of the what was bad about it wasn't necessarily well known at the time because buildings like that, and there's 45 other buildings like it around the United States, have been in operation for, I guess, over 20 years now. It's been well established what solitary confinement does, or reestablished, you could say, because there was a lot of information about it in the past people forgot. So that's what's led to the human rights conclusions. But that really puts down a marker of, like, now we know what's going to happen if you build another one of these. If you're not tremendously familiar with solitary confinement, that's a drawing by a prisoner who was in a cell in Pelican Bay. That's you basically, you're in that cell 23 hours a day. You're allowed what's called outside for typically an hour a day into a concrete kind of dog run with a cage over the top of it like that. That's considered your outside time. That kind of came about because of some legal conclusions by the U.S. Supreme Court, and you're entitled to constitutionally not be in your cell 24 hours a day. But you get people, it's pretty, I mean, the average stay, it's hard to compute as a national figure, but you have many people who've been in there for years. Pelican Bay, again, built in 1989. There are people who've been in there since the day it opened. And again, you know, even though the racial disproportionality of who ends up in solitary is higher. The way they tend to run them, and this may not be news to those of you who do correctional health, but anyway, yeah, that the building's really attempting to minimize physical contact so that everything's brought to your cell. The restrictions on your ability to communicate vary greatly from state to state. I'm from California. We probably have the most restrictive system. When you're in security housing unit, you get phone calls to your family if your mother or your father dies. Otherwise, there's no phone calls for decades. The fact that it causes mental illness it has now been pretty well established. And, you know, in most state systems, you've got 3 to 4% of people in solitary confinement, but you have about half of the prison suicides that occur are in the solitary unit. So that's a pretty, I think, a pretty clear indication. Now, I'm no epidemiologist, you all probably are, but anyway, probably a pretty clear indication that the situation there is totally destabilizing to people's mental health. So within solitary confinement, there's actually about 80,000 people in solitary confinement, which comes, prison authorities never use the term solitary confinement. They tend to call it segregation, disciplinary segregation, DDU, SHU, whatever. Within that population of 80,000, there's this group of about 45 supermax prisons, which hold about 20,000 of those people. And the reason I singled those out is that it was very clear from the inception of these buildings exactly what the purpose was. Which was to keep people in solitary confinement for a long period of time and to try and do it as cost-effectively as possible, because if they required massive levels of staffing, they're very expensive facilities, but they've been tried to drive down the cost as much as possible with automation. So in brief, my proposal, what I'm trying to do here is talk about professional responsibility. The American Institute of Architects is the main professional association in architecture. It has about 80,000 members. About 3/4 of licensed architects in the United States are members. So my little organization, Architects, Designers, Planners for Social Responsibility, is encouraging AIA to prohibit the design of spaces intended for human rights violations, including solitary confinement and executions. What's interesting is that our current code of ethics actually says that members should uphold human rights in all our professional endeavors. But it's only, that's at the standard level. It's only implemented with one rule, which is related to non-discrimination in employment, which is a good rule, but I would say that now that we're aware of these other kinds of spaces, that's not the only impact, that the only connection between human rights and architecture. If we're committed to upholding human rights, we probably shouldn't violate them by design. And I will say that in talking to other architects, the statements of many medical professional associations are an incredibly important precedent in trying to convince my fellow professionals that our profession could take a similar position. And, you know, there's one of the interesting things about this when you look at the death penalty and the way that the nurses have said it versus doctors, that nurses actually have a commitment to try and abolish the death penalty, which you'll see there. The AMA says that they are not taking a political position about the death penalty. They're trying to distance themselves from, you know, a critique of the policy, and they're saying, but on the other hand, because our professional ethic is to protect individual life, we shouldn't be involved with taking away anybody's life, even in that circumstance. So I think that, and both of those are potential models for AIA, you know, for my group to work with, and I think it's kind of useful to have a range of opinions, or at least not to have to come to them and say, you know, in addition to taking on this ethical position, we're committed to a legislative agenda of lobbying to abolish the death penalty, because that would probably be kind of unpopular as a first step. So I find actually the AMA one kind of, it's depoliticized in some ways. That's a valuable organizing tool, I guess you could say. And then when you kind of talk about torture and associated with torture is cruel, inhuman, and degrading treatment, I mean, there's good statements on this from medical associations also all the way across the board. So I think, and what's interesting, I mean, I don't know why they wrote it this way, but it says physicians should not provide premises to facilitate degrading treatment. But, you know, like, it's okay if architects do that, right? So I'm trying to change that. Oh, I'm doing well. So I've actually gotten some support from a number of legal organizations, including ACLU, because they do human rights in the United States. They helped me come up with some language, although I get some credit for this too, that, you know, it would be useful to have a rule that could be stated this way, although certainly, you know, if any of you have experience drafting human rights language or professional ethical language, please let me know, because that would be helpful. I think it's, you know, one of the things that I actually end up explaining to people a lot is that the U.S. constitutional rights and human rights are really separate. And the U.S. Constitution, in a U.S. court, you can only sue for your constitutional rights, and you can't sue for human rights. So even though the U.S. is committed to, at the human rights level, prohibiting cruel, inhuman, and degrading treatment, you can only sue under the U.S. Constitution if your treatment is cruel and unusual. And unusual means it has to be cruel and unusual. So if it's cruel but everybody's doing it, it's actually a really hard case to make that it's unconstitutional, even if it's clearly, say, degrading, which would get you in trouble at the UN, but that doesn't carry much weight in U.S. courts. So trying to structure a professional code of ethics so that it's clear that it's referring to the UN system and not to the U.S. system is actually one of the goals of writing this kind of ethical language, because, there are better standards out there than the U.S. system. Part of the argument that I make about why we're doing this is that AI actually has a recent tradition of promoting other public interest values. Our professional ethical code is mostly concerned with business practice. It's not a great code, although it could be worse. The British one is not any better. But recently it's been renovated to include sustainability and pro bono practice. I think one of the more interesting things is the potential implications for designers who do prisons. And I've talked to a bunch of them and spoke to them. They actually have a little conference within AIA, which I was at. And it's certainly not the case that all of them believe this, but a lot of the people who are trying to design correctional environments, like I think it's a similar situation with Kathy we're talking about, are trying to design humane environments for people. And, you know, their client, the superintendent, basically, and in some ways, since the state legislature or the county jail, you know, wants a secure facility. Security is usually your number one concern. And I feel like if we had this, they could come. But if your client comes to you and says, yeah, we want another Supermax prison. We want to build the first Supermax prison or whatever. Arizona has a project right now to build Supermax number 3 for their state. You say, you know, I can't help you violate people's human rights who are in your custody, but I can help you provide a secure environment that respects their human rights. You don't want to be in trouble with, you know, Amnesty International breathing down your neck all the time, so let's not build it that way as a supermax, but I understand that you want to build a prison. There's a lot of other problems with building a prison, but, you know, to put the people who are going to design prisons on the side of human rights and saying, I can help you avoid trouble, I hope is how they could interpret kind of the part of what's in here. And I think it's a different picture for doctors who work in there. Maybe we can talk about that a little bit later. And also, making this not a retroactive policy thing is actually a pretty big point, I think, for trying to get architects to agree with me that they would do this. In terms of where this campaign is at, we've gotten support. AI has the Code of Ethics is edited nationally, but individual local chapters are free to express their opinions. And so far, San Francisco chapter has been the first one to write a letter of support. I'm talking to the Boston Society of Architects tonight, so hopefully we'll get another letter from this city in maybe a month down the road from that. Amnesty International, National Religious Campaign Against Torture, both organizations that have endorsed what we're doing, and then some other groups within architecture and design, which are, of course, important. Just so you know, there's a lot of outreach that I'm doing through the Soros Fellowship that Bobby mentioned, so if any of you want to sign my petition, you're totally welcome. You don't need to be an architect to do that. AIA doesn't generally hear from the general public about that they would like AIA to do stuff. Architects feel very disconnected, so in some ways, outside of, you know, the construction industry, so that'd be helpful. You can learn about ADPSR and our stuff over there. And just kind of in closing, when I started off talking about, you know, architecture, human rights calls for us to design housing, medical care, I think there are great examples of architects designing that. And frankly, I think almost everybody who gets into the profession would like to do buildings that are of service to people. Very few people get into it wanting to design jails. Certainly nobody I have ever met said, yeah, my goal is to design an execution chamber. You know, if that's your goal, you probably wouldn't be an architect. But you can design a really elegant modern drug rehab center. You could renovate an old Catholic school building to be a community dispute resolution center. You could build, you know, a kind of slightly Italianate but budget-conscious building that's, you know, a home for a reentry program in San Francisco. These are all examples of fairly recent projects that I think embody the best of what our profession strives for. And what I try and tell people is, if we want to see enough of these projects to make a difference, we want to see the public investment in them, we have to say we can't keep treating people in prison, you know, as if they're subhuman, and we can't deny them their human rights if we want to see these projects really go ahead that are intended to realize their human rights. So that's me.